This week, mountain climber Alex Honnold became the first person to climb Yosemite's El Capitan without ropes or safety harnesses. And the reaction on social media was everything from, this guy's got a death wish, no way I would do that, on to, oh yeah, bucket list material. Which left me wondering, what did we call our big and sometimes larger than life goals before the 2007 Morgan Freeman, Jack Nicholson film of the same name? Weren't they just simply big goals, not bucket lists? Digging deeper, I looked at a lot of public lists declared as bucket lists and social media postings from people of all ages declaring various activities as quote-unquote bucket list material. And on social media, on blogs by famous and unfamous people alike, two things very quickly emerged. One, while one person's regular old Wednesday is another person's bucket list item, we seem to throw around this term bucket list pretty casually. Argument in favor of calling it something else, perhaps? Maybe. But the bigger thing that snapped into focus is in my lengthy but hardly scientific bout of field research here on this matter. It was this. There's almost always a catalyst that nudges most of us to do these things outside of our comfort zones, especially outside of the comfort zones of our day-to-day lives. Whether it's an eye-opening event that leaves us thinking, okay, you know what? I'm never going to play it safe ever again. Or if it's a vague feeling of needing to break out of our routines that grows louder until it's positively unignorable. There seems to be a through line of not just wanting, but needing to push ourselves, a moment in which the reward is suddenly greater than the risk. And research backs this up. An Australian university study recently found there's been a long misunderstanding of what motivates us to do especially extreme activities. It's not about irresponsibility or having a death wish. In fact, it is quite the opposite. The study finds that those who dare, such as the record-breaking mountain climber earlier this week, have in fact deep self-knowledge and trust, who know themselves and their skills and are often seeking an experience that is life-changing, who are compelled to take on something at one end or another of human agency that can be so very life-affirming, offer the potential for transformation, and so often calls forth greater sensory experiences than in our daily lives. Because rarely is an item on our bucket list really just about that one thing. It's not just that we want to, say, climb a mountain. It's that we want to immerse ourselves in the woods, in nature, in our own minds for hours or days or weeks and emerge having a measurable thing by which to declare our achievement and hopefully having had epiphanies and come just a tiny bit closer to understanding the meaning of life while en route. It's not just swimming with sharks or dolphins or riding an elephant. It's connecting vulnerably to another creature so different from ourselves. It's challenging ourselves and rising to the occasion. It's sacrificing to save for a trip to the other side of the world because we know somewhere deep down that we will be different when we return. It's expanding our horizons and emerging proud for having moved the needle day by day or for having stared fear in the face. But maybe we're overthinking it. Maybe some things are just on our big lifetime lists of things to do because they sound fun. But maybe by considering the why, we can expand and better enjoy the what. So tonight, that's what we'll consider. Very big life adventures and what drives us to name something worthy of our so-called bucket lists. I'm Amy Guth, and it's time for the Saturday Night Special on WGN Radio.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, you heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. And tonight on the program, we're going to be talking about those irresistible but sometimes rather terrifying things that are on our big life lists, sometimes called our bucket lists. But we're not just going to talk about where it would be very neat to visit or the wild adventures we dream of taking once we, you know, win the lottery or something like that. We're going to be talking about the motivations behind them, the benefit of facing our fears or committing to a wild idea. And certainly, we're going to be talking about the life-changing joy of having experienced something we've dreamed of doing for so long. We'll be talking with Dr. John Duffy about human motivation with author Robert Moore about how a huge, life-changingly giant undertaking like the Appalachian Trail is really about a lot more than hiking or trails. And with artist, writer, and activist Laura Carney, the woman behind a project called My Father's List. We have a pretty packed show, so I cannot swear and promise that we're going to be able to take too many calls, but esteemed producer Tom Hush will be the voice on the other end of the line if you would like to call and share an amazing story or big adventure of your own. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we pick one big old topic and we talk about it all night long. And tonight's topic is those very big life goals. Often we call them the bucket list items. But I'm not so sold on that term because I think it sometimes lessens what is really remarkable, go humans, go kind of stuff. And so as ever, whenever we need to talk about what makes us act that way, we bring in our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, who's here with us in studio tonight. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Always so happy to be here. Thank you.
So, you know, in the opening monologue, I was talking a little bit about this study that was done in an Australian university about people that take on these big endeavors. Particularly, they were talking about kind of extreme sports, and we were taking a little bit of a look at this mountain climber who made history this week, who, I mean, to see what he did, I've seen El Capitan, like to think of someone climbing that without safety harnesses is a little bit terrifying. But he described it as like floating and gliding, and it was the chillest thing ever.
Yeah.
And so that makes me wonder a little bit, and this research kind of backs this up, about perhaps it is not people one taco short of a combo plate taking on this big stuff.
Right.
But in fact, like people that are a little more self-aware, that have a little higher self-trust. And I think that's really interesting because then it kind of points to this idea of tackling big things as being something like stepping into a fuller human potential.
Yeah. And it definitely feels that way with your mountain climber. You think about what he did this week and the way he describes it. And it doesn't feel like somebody who has this death wish or is trying to just take a risk for the sake of taking a risk in this extreme way. It really feels like somebody who's trying to transcend what is our normal human experience and kind of test the limits of that. And it's interesting to me the way he describes it as kind of being this flow, this kind mm-hmm. of not this like fearful, I can't wait till this is over thing,
right.
But like, you know, I'm really
like the rest of us might be doing.
Right. But, you know, like this is something I'm really enjoying and it's maximizing something in me that I didn't know maybe was there yesterday.
Yeah. And there's a kind of a side story about this guy in which some neuroscientists have studied his brain because of his ability to control his fear,
mm-hmm.
which is very, very interesting to me. He said something, let's see, let me find it. He said, with free soloing, obviously I know that I'm in danger, but feeling fearful while I'm up there is not helping me in any way. It's only hindering my performance. So I just set it aside and let it be.
Wow.
And I mean, you can say that all day, but to do it, to be able to actually do that, I think is a really interesting thing. So I have a theory about fear I want to check with you, Dr. Duffy, and that
Let's
is this.
It.
So a lot of times we use the word fearless about mm-hmm. people that do things like that, that go and, wow, you've done all this cool bucket list stuff. You're so fearless. I think that it is something else because to me, fear is a roadmap. If I find myself being afraid of something, it's a signal. It's like a little pain point of like, here's something you need to dust off and deal with. You need to fix it. Now, that has made me do some really crazy stuff in my life because mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I'm afraid of that. I better go deal with it.
<You know? laughs> Right.
So that's had me like, well, hang gliding seems totally reasonable. Let's do that or whatever. and things like that. But I think there, I don't know. I've always thought of fear as being a thing that prompts me.
Yeah.
As opposed to, but fear is an interesting thing, right? Because it can hold us back. It usually holds us back from doing things. I'm afraid of looking stupid. I'm afraid of saying the wrong thing or making a fool of myself.
Yeah.
But I think perhaps it's when we use it as a, I'm afraid not to do this.
Yeah, I love that. About 10 years ago, there was a book that came out. It was kind of a sensation for a brief period of time called The Gift of Fear. And it was really about like when to exercise due caution, when to cross the street, when you have that spider sense tingling. Mm. But when I think about the gift of fear, I think like you do. I think like it's your body telling your mind, you know, maybe we should really have a look at this and see whether there's something to expose ourselves to, something to learn from this. Because, you know, I think sometimes the body's a step ahead of the mind. And I think about some of the people I treat who are phobic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the bucket list fearful thing is, I want to be able to go in and sit in that restaurant for 15 minutes without panicking.
Yeah.
And that's the, and when you can do that, I think that opens doors to, maybe I'm capable of something more than I thought I was.
See, I think that's a really important point, because how often have you done something and then immediately after you're like, oh my gosh, that was super fun.
Right.
But you spent weeks being afraid of it. And at the end of it, you're like, oh my God, I want to do that again.
That's a roller coaster effect, right? I'm getting back in line.
Totally. I was going to say, like roller coasters, like skydiving, like all of those things that you dread and you're thinking, what in the world? So I weirdly developed a fear of heights at about like somewhere in my early 30s, out of nowhere. Just one day I was on a plane and I had a window seat and I looked down and I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And I had never had that before.
Right.
So I was like, I can't have this. I don't want this thing chaining me.
Yeah.
I got to figure it out. So I made myself do stuff to try to confront it. And one of the most terrifying things I did was to get on the Ferris wheel in Navy Pier.
Oh, I'm sure.
I was a basket case in line. I brought somebody with me and I was like, we could go. We could just leave. We could go to lunch. We don't have to do this. And she was like, no, we're going. We're going. And she had no problem. She was like, oh, I've been on it a ton of times. It's so fun. It got stuck as we were at the top.
Wow.
For several minutes.
Flooding. That's all.
I know.
You were like, flooded with your fear.
Flooded with it. And it was gone. It's exactly what, I mean, there we were at the top and I was like holding on and I thought, wow, this is beautiful and nobody else has this view.
Right.
I want to take a picture, but I'm going to have to let go of this railing if I want to take a picture. I can do that with one hand. And, you know, my friend, of course, she's like trying to wiggle the car. I was like, just one thing at a time, please.
Yeah,
like, come on,
give me a break.
But by the time it was over, by the time that the car started to move again, I was like, this is fine.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting how it dissolved to dust by exposure to it.
Yeah. And that, you know, as you are likely know, when we treat fear, anxiety, phobias, exposure is a big part of that. But what we're talking about here, I think, is like recognizing something that doesn't disrupt your life, right? This isn't something diagnostic. These are situations we're kind of curious about that draw us in some way, but fear stops us from stepping into it, right? You know, that's your fear of heights. You could have lived with that.
Sure.
You could have, right, you know.
I could have just had the aisle seat.
Fine. Yeah, exactly. but there was something about you that wanted to challenge yourself.
Yeah.
And there's something transcendent, apparently, about the challenge, right? And winning the challenge. And then there's the beauty of, oh, wow, this is something interesting. This is a different experience than I've ever had before. And you're a little richer for it. There's a new pathway set in your brain that allows for like, okay, I can do this again. And this height thing doesn't own me like it used to. And quite the contrary, I may do something that challenges that even further.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Fast forward a couple of years. I'm standing on top of Table Mountain in South Africa going, oh, this is pretty awesome. And it didn't even occur to me that I was up so high.
There we have it.
At the bottom later, I was like, oh, wait, I would have freaked out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So
I say a couple, like many years ago.
Still.
But yeah. So it's almost like, but okay, so this is what's interesting to me about this idea of tackling things on like a big life list or bucket list or something like that, is that everyone's can be so different. Mm-hmm. I mean, to somebody, it could be, you know, I want to go to New York City, but to somebody who goes to New York every week on business, that's no big deal.
Right.
And so it's really kind of, to me, about like a sense of, I almost want to call it incremental expansion.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Like step by step, because there's no one thing that's going to, you know, what might be really appealing to one person is going to be like, I don't care if I ever go there or not.
Right, right.
So then it almost guarantees that by doing something on your, you know, bucket list or master life list or whatever you want to call it, you're almost guaranteed to have a follow-up.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, that's inevitably going to be the case. And the follow-up will undoubtedly up the ante a little bit, right? And there is something that feels very much alive about that and very future-oriented. You know, I think that's part of the draw is, you know, like so much of life is so kind of pedestrian, routinized, ordinary. And when you get to the bucket list idea, right, I'm gonna challenge myself a little bit to try something different and have a new experience, even if I'm a little afraid of it or very afraid of it. Mm-hmm. There's something lively about that, right? It's like, you know, okay, my story isn't written. It's not over because this part's going to be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. My grandfather one time called me out because he would always ask me on my birthday, what did you do the most this year and what do you want to do in the year ahead? And I gave him the same answer a couple of years in a row. I was like, well, I've been working a lot this year, but you know, this year I'm going to do even more work and do a better job. He's like, you know what, kid? There's a little bit more to work. I was like, I know, but it's so fun. He's like, yeah, I want you to challenge yourself to do 100 things you've never done before.
Oof.
Even things that I was like, anything? He goes, I don't care what it is. Figure it out. And I ended up kind of making a public thing about it. And it grew to a longer list because it was very interesting, like silly stuff. Like, well, I've never made marshmallows. I'm going to make them. I've never had a drink out of a pineapple. I'm going to do that. Little things that weren't about fear. They were just about, what is that experience? What's the big deal about it?
Right,
and then
right.
Turns out, like, making marshmallows is kind of a giant mess, but drinking out of a pineapple, pretty fun.
Yeah, it's sometimes just stepping out of that routine, right?
Yeah.
The drinking out of the pineapple. I remember having a guy in my office not long ago who was looking for a mantra. Mm. And what he finally came up with was, I want to start writing the better story. With every decision I make, I want to write the better story. And I had just gotten a new chair. And he said, well, I guess the better story. Does anybody ever sit in the chair? And I said, no, not yet. And he said, I guess the better story is I get up and I go over there and I sit in the chair. And I'm like,
sure.
I suppose that's right, you know? And he sat down in it and kind of wiggled around for a minute. And he said, that's a pretty decent chair, you know, but he felt like he was trying something new and that was the better story, you know, and
I like that.
And I kind of like that idea, you know, and I think that's part of what the bucket list is about, is like, is there a better story I could write here?
I like that very much. Yeah. I think it's the same thing that is interesting to people about when the seasons change. People walk, oh, I love fall. Look at all the beautiful leaves, or, oh, it's cooler, or it's when there's something different because we've gotten used to a season. If we've been bundled up all winter, suddenly, oh, it's warm and everything's green. It's that change that kind of shakes us up and prompts us to stir our senses a little bit, kind of forces us out a little bit.
Yeah.
All interesting stuff. See, it's always the case. We think a topic will be very straightforward. We start digging into it. There's a lot to it. So we're going to take a little break. I'm here with Dr. John Duffy, and tonight's topic is all about the big life goals that we tackle, sometimes called the bucket list. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big old topic and we talk about it all night, many, many different aspects of it with many, many smart people. And tonight, that topic is those very big life goals. Sometimes we say the bucket list. I'm trying to stay away from that term because I think it maybe undermines a very powerful thing, because as we have already uncovered on the program with our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, who's here in studio with us, it's not really about hiking that mountain or jumping out of that plane or whatever the thing is. It is always about so much more, and it is about this kind of incremental expansion is the term we arrived at in the last segment before the news there. So as we, you know, we've been talking a lot about a very extreme stuff and things like that, and things on, you know, bucket lists that a lot of people probably have, like skydiving and climbing mountains, and I think I named petting an elephant because that's something I want to do. But you know, I think it can be a lot of things on a bucket list. It can be travel. It can be sometimes, like what I said earlier, like your Wednesday might be somebody else's bucket list thing, you know? So I think what is the stuff we need to think about if we're trying to make a bucket list that challenges us appropriately, but doesn't set us up to disappoint ourselves?
Right. And that's part of the incremental part, I think, is like, you know, your first step might not be jumping out of the airplane, right? It might be taking the ride when somebody else does that,
sure.
You know, and like kind of graduating your exposure to the stimulus that fears you or
right.
that makes you anxious, you know? I also think that part of it is to think about, and we'll stay away from the term bucket list, but this idea of expansion being a little bit of a blueprint for how we want to really live our lives, not necessarily just in those few moments, right? In those, you know, 50 or 100 moments, but maybe you want a little more excitement in your life on a day-to-day basis, you know? And this is just an indication, you know, when you're compelled to make a list, that you want more out of your life than you're getting right now.
I have to imagine that there's probably some similarity to when someone says, okay, I'm doing this, as to like the kind of thing that would prompt somebody into, I mean, probably prompt someone to come to your office or
sure.
seek help or fight an addiction or something like that. It seems like sometimes it's hitting a bottom, but sometimes it's also just, I can't do this way anymore.
Right.
I'm going to do this differently.
Yep. Yeah, courage comes in funny forms, right? You know, there was a young man who came to my office. He's 22 years old, and he knows that he has to stop drinking. And, you know, the culture all around him suggests 22-year-olds,
sure,
I can binge
up.
Drink.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to even notice. And so the courage for him is, okay, I'm going to work on curbing this, and then I'm going to work on quitting, even though that's so hard for me to do. Like, you know, this this is his big step. And I think once he accomplishes that and proves himself, he's not necessarily saying, I'll never ever do this again. But I think if he goes a year without drinking and shows himself, wow, I have so much agency that I didn't know I had. Maybe I can apply that to something else in my life that's, you know, expansive in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is a really interesting part. But I too wonder about, I think sometimes it's tempting if you want to make some kind of like a bucket list or big life goals to, well, it's hard to imagine your future self. I think that's part of it. But I feel like sometimes it can be very discouraging if you like bite off a really big goal.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to, you know, hike the Great Wall of China, I don't
right.
know, picking something, and suddenly you're like, okay, wait, now I got to come up with a whole bunch of money to get there. I got to walk a really long way, so I better be in good shape. And then I got to do this. I go, okay, and it seems overwhelming. Or if it's something like I had a friend who, she had to run a marathon on hers, and she sprained her ankle towards the end of it. And she's like, oh, I failed this thing. I'm like, well, but not really. I didn't feel like she failed at all. She raised
right.
a lot of money for a good cause. She got there. She did it. It was the pothole. I blame the pothole, not her, not
no
her
kidding.
Foot, you know. So I think there's some, I don't know, I don't think we should set goals with wanting to buttress them in case we don't meet them or they don't go off the way we think.
It's a really good point. We were talking a little while ago about process versus outcome, right?
Yeah.
And I think we get overly tied to the outcome. I've got to cross that finish line as opposed to, you know what? I'm here. I started. I did my very best, you know, and
it was fun.
And it was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was expensive. Something changed in me, you know, like I feel like, boy, that's pretty impressive. That's a pretty good day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed. I think that process versus outcome is key, but it's a fine line, right? Because you want to say, I have achieved X.
Yes.
I have whatever, run a marathon. I have donated $1,000 to charity or whatever your thing is. Well, donating, you know, 900 is not the same as,
right.
you know,
right.
not the same.
It might be part of our aversion to the words bucket list is that,
yeah.
you know, it has this very objective criteria, right? And it's either you win or you fail somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think our point is showing up is pretty good. You know, showing up
yeah.
and doing your best and leaving everything on the field, so to speak, that's the win, you
yeah.
know? Or we like to think that's the win.
Sure.
And it maybe ought to be. As opposed to, you know, yes, I finished every single of the 26.2 miles.
It's like, I'm just glad to be nominated. Well, right. sometimes it's okay to just be glad to be nominated
right.
and not
right.
win the
Good
Oscar.
Exactly.
So I would be pretty stoked if I was nominated for an Oscar or something.
Of course.
Be like, okay, that's pretty good. I have no expectation of winning. I'm just pretty excited to be sitting here in this auditorium, right?
And using that analogy, you don't have agency over whether you win, right? You might have agency over like how good a job you do and,
right.
you know, I got there. I got that, you know, I got that nomination or I made it to mile 24 and then the pothole took me out of my
totally
game.
Totally derailed
right?
me.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I as a runner, I have the first long race I ever ran, I said, you know what? It's tempting to say, I want to run this sub-4 marathon. I want to, but I'm like, I don't know what I don't know
right.
until I have done this. So I just want to finish. I just want to get to the finish line and know that I did my best. That's all I want. It was nowhere near a 4 hour. It was way longer because I had no idea what I was biting off. But then after that, I knew what I was getting into and knew how to plan.
And potentially you may change that at some point. Right? You may decide like, well, maybe I will want to trim a little time off that. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll run another one. Maybe I never will, right? Right. So, you know, I think maybe there's something individualized about this thing that is okay, you know, that it doesn't have to be absolute.
Well,
you know?
And I think they can be moving targets.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I know someone who ran a marathon, said, kind of like me, just said, I just want to finish this one. And then said, okay, the second one, I'm going to care about time, but got injured.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became, this is going to be really hard. Okay, I just want to finish this one.
Right.
And then got a different injury and then had kids and all this stuff. And so it was like, I just want to do another.
Yeah.
And so it was still this running goal. She was mm-hmm. still a runner, but it was just, it was a moving target to her. And it wasn't like she shelved one for another. It just, there was just subtle shifts in her that brought her to this, you know, kept her focusing on the same target, even though it had moved.
You know, and sometimes even if you shelve one for another, the target can move that much. I'm thinking of a woman I worked with a couple of years ago, and she wanted to be a dancer until she was taking dance classes. And there was a musician who kind of just played along, and she learned a guitar and decided, and she shapeshifted completely. And her goal became, oh, I want to write music. And so she's done that successfully. So her bucket list shifted completely to something, a whole different kind of vocational drive.
Yeah.
But that worked for her.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That excited her maybe in a different or bigger way than dance did.
So yeah.
I think that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. We need to take a little break. But when we come back, I want to talk about this term bucket list because I fear that we might be making something too small that is in fact quite big. So we'll be back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And tonight we are talking all about very, very big life goals that we each have. So I can't say what's a big goal to you is a big goal to someone else. But you know what? We all have goals. We all have those things we think about or dream about doing. Sometimes we call them bucket lists. And so that's what we're talking about tonight. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking with a couple of people who are doing really interesting things around this idea of bucket lists and very, very big goals, because it rarely is about just accomplishing that one thing and crossing it off a list. There's much more to it. So as ever, anytime we need to say, what in the world makes people act that way, we bring our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, in to visit us. Always glad to have you here with us. So we've been talking about kind of the motivation part and what makes us tick, what makes us do that.
Right.
But I want to shift a little to this idea of bucket list because I'm really resisting that term as mm-hmm. as we're going in the show. And I think it's because I feel like it makes a very big and expansive and powerful thing sound small and silly and kitschy.
Yeah, trite.
Yeah, it sounds like no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I've also, as I was preparing for the show, I was looking at a lot of social media, friends and strangers, to see what they had identified as bucket lists. Now, far be it from me to say anybody's bucket list thing is big or small or whatever.
Right.
But I saw some things, particularly on Instagram, like trying on a particular dress that was like, by so-and-so designer, oh, bucket list. Like, okay, it might be bucket list material for you to own an Oscar de la Renta ball gown.
Right.
For sure. That, mm-hmm. And I'm not going to stop you. But when you compare that to something like, I don't know, hiking the Appalachian Trail mm-hmm. or skydiving, it seems trivial. I think maybe because it's material.
Right.
Also.
Right. True.
There's that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm struggling with it.
No, it is a struggle. And the term itself, especially, and I don't know if it's the movie that kicked this in,
right.
You know, but it suggests an end. There's something about it that bothers me in that regard, because it suggests like, this is what we want to do before we die. You know, mm-hmm. that's the bucket. Before we kick the bucket.
It also suggests something that you put off until you are faced with your own mortality.
Exactly.
When in reality, hey, I've watched cartoons. That piano could fall, that anvil or whatever could fall out of the sky and mow right. me down any minute.
Yeah, acme is everywhere.
Coyotes, roadrunners, all the things. I know how this plays out, right? I mean, we joke, but in fact, you know, things happen. Terrible things happen every day in this world, and freak accidents and, you know.
You never know.
That next bus on Michigan Avenue could have my name on it,
right.
And it's all done. And I like to think that, I think we all want to think at the end of our lives that we will, A, have a minute, and B, you know, be able to say, I've done all the things
yeah.
That I aim to do.
Right, right.
I had a relative who was over 100 when she died. And the day that she died, she was a big list maker. The day that she died, she looked at her son-in-law and she said, well, I've done everything. I'm going to go lie down. He took that to mean a nap because she took one every day.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 minutes later, he stuck his head in the room to say, to ask her a question about something, and she had died.
Wow.
And at 102, or I think 100, yeah, she was 102. At that age, you kind of can't be sad about it, especially if that's the last thing she said.
Right.
You're
right.
Like, well, she did it. She's mm-hmm. good. I mean, she'd even finished her library books and put them by the back door, paid the bills, like done everything. And I think we all kind of want that. That's the ideal. There's yeah. no better way to go. But I think saying bucket list implies that we're just going to kind of like slug along. And at the last minute, when we feel the end is nigh, we'll go, whoa, I better go do all these things.
Better not knock these things out. Right.
Yeah.
And if that's the idea, I always get this impression like, I don't know if people really intend for that stuff to happen. Whereas
right.
it's like kind of like a wish list or these are things I intend to accomplish. And maybe bucket list isn't powerful enough in a way, you know,
yeah.
because there's not it doesn't suggest a whole lot of intent. Right. And I like the idea that if something's meaningful to us, you know, we're going to set some degree of intention underneath that mm-hmm. so that, you know, we are at least giving it a fighting chance to happen, right? You
right.
know, that you know, we're going to lay the groundwork and we're not going to wait until the end is nigh. We're
right.
going to start that now for
right.
at least some of these things.
Well, and also, like you were talking about earlier, the idea that by accomplishing something, there's probably something behind it.
Yeah.
The promise of that is just almost too irresistibly sweet to say, I'm going to put off all this crap to the end of my life.
Right.
Because inevitably, it's going to be replaced by something else. And you'll be like, well, great.
Yeah.
I don't have time now to go do this thing that I'm super excited about behind that.
And that might mean more to me, right? This is what it's all been leading up to. And
right.
man, I'm never going to do that. You
right.
know? Yeah.
So there's, I think procrastination is a piece here too.
Yeah.
I believe procrastination is usually fear of discomfort or perceived discomfort, even if it's not going to be uncomfortable. We don't want to write that book report or do that thing or whatever. So we're like, I'll do it the last minute. Because then you don't have a choice.
Oh, you are so right on that. I so agree with you on that. And it's a fallacy because the feeling of procrastination is far worse, I think most people would argue, at the back end than just doing the thing.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just do the thing.
I read a piece recently about procrastination. And one way is because we're very concerned with how we feel about doing things. And so this piece, I think it was in Inc. maybe, or mm-hmm. Fast Company, suggested it actually doesn't matter how you feel about it. Tell your brain, I don't care if you like it or not, we're doing this now.
Right.
Which I think is a really interesting experiment. So there was a project that I was like, oh man, I don't want to do this one part of it. And I go, oh, okay, I'm going to try that thing. And I said, okay, brain, it doesn't matter if you like it or not. It doesn't matter if you feel good about it. It is the time now to do this. And like, I begrudgingly got going and then it was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's better than fine. You know, like
yeah.
I'm thinking about different challenges that people have taken on either in my office or immediately leaving my office. And sometimes it's just like, you know, we could sit here and we could talk about the deep psychological underpinnings of what's preventing you from doing the thing. Or you can make the phone call. Just go do the thing, you know, and you'll feel better in all likelihood having done the thing or tried the thing at the very least.
Yeah. I was at a writing conference one time and I heard somebody stand up at this panel and ask this novelist. He said, okay, I've just gotten my MFA. And what steps do you think I should take next? And she goes, I think you should sit your butt down and do some writing, which I thought was so good because she's right.
Right,
like you can get another MFA, you can go get a PhD, you could talk about it, you could think about it, you could brainstorm, you could map it all day. But at some point, you're going to have to sit down and write that book.
That's right. And you can talk yourself out of that until the end of time, right?
Yeah.
I'm not prepared for that. I need another degree for that.
I'm not qualified enough. Yeah, there's
right.
so many
I'm not inspired
things.
Today, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, anytime I have heard anything like, I don't know if I'm qualified enough. I don't know if I'm like, have you read a newspaper in this country in the last 6 months? Because I think you might find an example of some underqualified things.
Correct.
Going quite well for certain parties. That's all I'm going to say about that because it's not a politics show tonight.
Exactly.
But, you know, there's a thing that plenty of people will say, will not let a qualification or a credential stop them.
Right.
They'll just go like, I see a thing, I'm going to go do it.
Yeah.
And I think other people will go and, I better go get a master's if I'm going to do that or talk about that or something like that.
And it's always a curiosity to me who's empowered, who's not, and what makes up that difference, you know?
Do you think that is?
I often think it's parenting, you know? We were talking about that a little bit earlier, yeah. You know, and I think parents have an awful lot of power in our lives just to get us thinking certain ways about ourselves, you know, just, and if we believe like, I'm a capable person. I mean, sometimes it's just as fundamental as that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm capable, competent, resilient. I can handle what's thrown at me and I can take on the world. And I think sometimes we're coddled a little bit too much.
Probably.
We start to believe, maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I think I have the opposite problem. I think I'm like, I could figure that out to anything. Like, I could probably build a rocket. I'll just look it up on YouTube. I'm good, which gets me in a world of trouble sometimes.
But it's better than the alternative,
I would argue. That's true. Yeah. Of thinking like, oh, I can't. Right.
Right.
Indeed. Well, there's a lot here. See, there's a lot of stuff. So in the next hour, we're going to be talking with some others who are thinking about this topic in different ways in their lives, too. We're going to be talking with a woman who is doing a project called My Father's List, and she's taken on the bucket list her father left behind. And we're going to be talking with her about that and that big project. And we're going to be talking with an author who wrote about his experience hiking the Appalachian Trail. But in fact, it is about so much more than that. So very much more. Really, really fascinating book. So we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening with many, many different aspects of it. And we're here with Dr. John Duffy, who's here hanging out with us in studio tonight. Always a pleasure to have you with us. And so the topic tonight is those big, big life goals, sometimes called the bucket list, sometimes called the master life list, all kind of names, but it's really all the same thing. It's all those things we have in our heads. It's something I want to do during my lifetime. And our next guest, Laura Carney, she is a writer, she is an editor, she's an artist and an activist, and she holds a very different piece of this. And this is my favorite part about doing these shows with many different aspects around one topic, is that we get to see a lot of different points of view around this. And so as we've been sitting here talking about our own bucket lists and our own incremental expansion and things like that, and challenging ourselves and getting in our own way and things like that, Laura has a very different kind of project. And so she joins us by phone. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, there you are. We've got you.
Hi,
thanks so much.
How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for being with us tonight and taking part of your Saturday night to join us. I appreciate you.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, so I think your project is so very interesting, and there are so many pieces to it, and it is a bit of an emotional roller coaster of a project. But for those who have not, you can visit My Father's List online and read about this project. But tell us about it and how you came to create this list, this project around this list.
Sure. Well, you know, it's developed very quickly. Essentially, my brother bought a house back in November, and my husband and I were visiting him. And about 13 years before he had bought this house, we lost our father. He was in a car crash with a teenager who was on her phone, and she ran a red light. So I was about 25, and he was 23 when that happened. And we just sort of coincidentally got married in the same year, and we were up there celebrating that he got this new house. His wedding was about 3 weeks away. And he says, oh, I have to show you something. And his fiance brings out this little leather pouch, and within the pouch were a few things that belonged to my dad that, you know, I sort of knew that he had. But I didn't know that in that pouch was a list. And it was about like 3 pages of notebook paper where my dad had apparently written down 60 different things he wanted to do in his life. And I said, oh, okay, I sort of knew about this. You know, like I knew that my dad had the tendency to have big goals and you know, to just write them down and talk about them. And I knew that, you know, he and my mom sort of laughed about them a little bit. And I didn't ever know that there was one master list. So it was like, this was it. And we were finding this like buried treasure. And I sort of had this thought at the same time as my husband said it out loud, which was, you need to write about this. You know, he's like, this is your book, because since my father's car crash, I had wanted to somehow, you know, commemorate him, give his life some dignity, you know, because when someone dies that way, it does feel like they're very disposable in a sense. And I, when I was 25, I struggled with that a lot. And I had never really figured out quite the right formula for it. But when I saw this list and I realized, okay, well, my brother and I have already done quite a, like at least like 13 of these things just by coincidence. So that leaves like 40 or something. So we could do the rest of these and I could write about it. And I just thought that is such a wonderful solution because it celebrates a person's life and it doesn't put so much emphasis on this tragic way that they died.
Right. And at the time, when you found the list, how many things had your father done on that list of 60 items?
He had done 5 total.
And so,
it was a little disappointing.
Sure. And was there a moment's hesitation in your mind when you saw the list of, I have to do these? Or right away, did you think, it's on, I'm doing it?
I mean, it's sort of like, in my soul, like in my spirit, no, there was no hesitation whatsoever. It was like, I knew immediately, this is it. Like, this is what I need to be doing. And when my husband said it out loud, this is your book, I've actually pictured my dad's face in my head, smiling and nodding. And, you know, I've had like most people, I've had little messages here and there from my dad since he passed away, like a song or, you know, like he died on August 8th. Sometimes I'll see like the number 8 twice, but I'd never actually seen him like agreeing to something wholeheartedly, like in my mind. So that was a pretty good sign for me that it was like, okay, let's do this.
And so on the website, My Father's List, you have been blogging about taking on all these projects and recently you did the skydiving one, which was very interesting. And, you know, you've put that on social media and talked about that and that kind of thing. And as you've done this, have you had to kind of reckon any of them with yourself going, okay, I don't want to do this, but I recognize this is about a bigger thing?
Yeah, well, skydiving for sure. Just because, you know, I went into it and I do try to research each thing a lot before I do it. But that was one I didn't research enough. And I went into it very afraid and just thinking like, God, you know, I could really die doing this. And am I still presenting the right message if that happens to me? But essentially, once I was up there about 5,000 feet and then 10,000 feet, I just thought to myself, okay, well, if this is it, then I'm going out the way I lived. You know, I'm at least I don't have any regrets. Like I'm still spreading this message of celebrating life by doing this. And, you know, luckily I was okay. But like minutes before I jumped out, I just imagined my dad would be telling me, you know, let go. Like, these people are professionals. They know what they're doing. Like, I'm a copy editor at a magazine, so I'm usually just a little bit of a control freak. But, and that's the way, honestly, that's the way that it's been with the 5 that I've accomplished so far. And I think it's probably going to continue that way for the next few years. Every single list item that I check off, there's some kind of lesson that I'm getting from my dad, which it's always very obvious to me that it's him. And that's been such like a miraculous experience for me because it's, you know, he's not actually physically here on this planet, but the lessons he gave me as a child, it's sort of like, this is like the next level of them.
Hi, Laura. Hey, it's Dr. John Duffy. I'm lucky enough to be sitting in with Amy tonight, and I'm a little bit familiar with your story. We've been talking about bucket lists and things like that tonight. Not often, maybe never before, have I heard of somebody's list choosing them in a way. And I think back to about 20 years ago, I lost my own father. And the night before he died, he gave me a couple of mandates that he wanted me to fulfill that I thought at the time, oh, this is no big deal. I'll be able to do this. Now, 20 years later, I'm thinking, geez, thanks a lot, Dad. Do you ever find yourself, is there anything on that list where you're like, geez, Dad, thanks a lot for laying this one on me?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit different only in that he never actually said you have to do these things, you know, so mm-hmm. I can understand how that might feel. And I do wish in a way that I had that conversation with him before he died, that where, you know, there could have been some closure in a sense. And that's a little bit of what I write about, like kind of trying to achieve this closure after his death. But yeah, you know, I swam across a river in Asheville, North Carolina, about a month ago. And I had a moment where I was just standing in the middle of this river, and it was very, like, river runs through it kind of scenery, if you can imagine. Like, beautiful, like, the sun is shining, like, just, you know, the Blue Ridge Mountains all around me and just trees. And I just kept getting knocked over. Like, I probably got knocked over, like, 40 times, like, going, you know, across this river and then back again because the current was ridiculous. And I stood up, and I just was like, okay, I'm going to just stand still for a second, just take a break. And I said out loud, why did you want to do this? You know, like, this makes no sense. You know, why is this one of your goals? But once I was finished, I totally understood why he wanted to do it. Because if you have an experience like that where you're in open water and you're able to feel one with nature in that way, that's such like a triumph. Like, it's such an incredible thing to feel that you don't have to be afraid of what's underneath. So, I mean, while in the process, I just thought, this is crazy. Like, why am I doing this? You know, this is crazy. But once it was over, I was so happy that I did.
Well, that's a theme that's come up a little bit on the show so far. Is kind of about, it's, well, two things that you've just touched on. One, that it's not really about doing the thing. It's about something much bigger and much more expansive. But then also the idea that sometimes as soon as we can dread something so much, but as soon as we walk through that door, there's that fear is just gone. It's just dissolved.
Right. Well, also a lot of times I think we're the most afraid of the things that we're supposed to be doing because they carry a certain weight to them and a certain power. And I think usually you can tell the difference. If there's something that's just, you know, like I like to talk about this. There's this quote that Drew Barrymore has from a few years ago where she used to say, you should do the thing that makes you so afraid that you want to throw up. Because you know in your gut if it's affecting your body to that level that there's something in your spirit that wants to do that thing, and you just have to make yourself do that thing. But, you know, then there's those things where it's like, oh, you know, I kind of like, this gives me a bad feeling just thinking about this thing, and maybe you shouldn't do that thing. But if it's something where you're afraid because you wonder if you yourself are good enough to do it, mm-hmm. or if you have the ability to do it, then I think that's a different kind of fear.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder too how this is impacting you personally as you're doing all of these things. Are you finding, you know, we were using this term earlier, incremental expansion. I think that's probably very tied to, well, to letting go of pieces of fear. I think it's probably tied to maybe expanding confidence, things like that. Have you noticed that shift as you've started down this path?
Yeah, I'm certainly, I think, my true self, I think, is coming out in ways that I had been, you know, unconsciously repressing. I think because this is maybe a unique situation where it's a daughter doing her father's list, what I'm coming to realize is I actually am very much like him. I have a lot of traits that he had, and maybe because of being a different gender, or because, you know, maybe some of those traits that he had, I misjudged or looked at differently. I sort of was not allowing myself to have them, and to express them to their full extent. And now that I am, it's like there's so much freedom in that for me. And I'm also finding that I have to sort of let myself be different. I can't be guided as much by, well, what is everybody else doing? And, you know, that to me, like I think there was something that aligned in me immediately when I had this, when my husband had this idea and I agreed with him, you know, just give credit where it's due. But what aligned in me immediately was there was something about pursuing this kind of unique thinking, this kind of like being focused on a goal kind of thinking that was going to, I think, more helpfully convey a message about distracted driving, the way my father was killed. Because so often what I think happens to people who are using their phones when they're driving is, even though, you know, we kind of know, okay, we read in the paper, you're not supposed to do this, we hear on TV, this is killing people, but it's like this habit, like smoking or something, or it's like, you know, you're just like, oh, I can't stop doing it. And that's because everybody's doing it. So there's this energy behind it where you're just kind of following the masses. And it's very, very easy to live that way. And I think you can lose yourself really easily when you live that way. It's just a lot less scary to live that way. But living that way right now is actually killing people, you know? Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like people, I think, become inspired when they see what I'm doing and they think, oh, maybe I should incorporate that into my life a little bit. So my hope is if they're incorporating that attitude and philosophy into their own life, it kind of touches on, well, hey, I don't have to do what everybody's doing. Like if I get in the car, I'm not, you know, like fear of missing out. I'm not getting FOMO by not checking my phone. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It's kind of a dual purpose.
That's kind of a beautiful story, Laura. And I wondered if the activism about the, you know, the drivers who are distracted, was that part of a list that your dad didn't write, you know, that you felt like compelled to kind of pursue as part of your life? Because I got the impression that that wasn't necessarily a press for you, you know, right upon the loss of him, right? This is something you had to decide to do at some point.
Right. Well, I didn't even make the connection until 10 years later that the phone had been part of it. I had always sort of thought as this fluke thing and, you know, what a tragedy. And, you know, usually when there's a tragedy, people don't really like to talk about it a whole lot. So it was something I sort of avoided. And I almost even saw it as a stigma. And, you know, that was very difficult for me because he was such a huge influence on my life, to just sort of pretend like this didn't happen or this didn't exist. It's just too hard to discuss it. And also, you know, when you think about someone as big a figure as your father, you know, which is interesting, Father's Day is tomorrow. It's like, you know, he's sort of like a hero, like a superhero. And it's like, you can't imagine a 17-year-old girl could take down someone like that. So it does feel almost a little bit shameful. But when I discovered, okay, this probably was the phone, and then I became active in that community of people who are trying to change that. And then, you know, 3 years later, I found this list. To me, it was sort of like, this is totally what he believed in, that he, you know, as I've discovered with many people who've lost someone this way, and there are so many of them, it's almost unbelievable to me how many of them I've been meeting. So often they say, oh, my dad was so safe. He was such a safe driver. He never would have done this. He never would have been involved in something like this. So, you know, for me, what I talk about a lot is how present my dad always was. You know, when you were in a conversation with him, even though he was just a larger than life personality, and I was kind of like this quiet, shy kid, you know, for most of my childhood, he always listened to everything I had to say, you know, and it was like you always felt like he was the center of your attention. So to me, definitely the way he lived his life is something that, you know, would be something to be emulated and would certainly be tied to this message.
Which it seems that you are so doing through this list and how you've described as you write about the things you're taking on, particularly as you were writing about the running that you did when taking on these long miles, about how present you were during them and all that. That really struck me as an interesting parallel, though, to what you just said.
Well, the other thing is it takes a lot of training. Like I'm not, except for the skydiving, which I figured, okay, how much training do I need to know beforehand before I actually go and have the class and have them show me how to do it? The other things I've been doing with the swimming and with the running, you know, you have to have the discipline to train your body to be able to do these things before you do them. And I think, you know, we live in a time where people kind of have become accustomed to getting things right away. It's just so much easier. You can look up any answer you need immediately. You don't have to rack your brain too much to try to remember something. So that's definitely different. And it's almost kind of funny to me because my dad, I mean, he was alive long enough to see the internet, but like he used to call it a glorified phone book, you know, and like he would talk about the advances in technology all the time. And he would say to my brother and me, like, oh, you're so lucky. You're living the information age. You're going to see so much happen. But I don't know. Like I just can't imagine him ever picking up a phone while driving a car. Yeah. Like I just really can't. And he was the kind of person who, you know, just the other day I was remembering, I stopped at the beach after skydiving. It was like this treat I gave myself. And I saw a sundial and I was remembering how he used to teach us how to make sundials when we were at the beach. Like, why would we need to know that for any reason? But I think he's, as many fathers do, I think he was sort of, you know, always preparing us for any particular situation. Like if we were stuck somewhere, like just giving us these basic life survival skills. So I think ultimately the fact that I do have to train for each thing that I'm doing, he would totally be in favor of that. And I think, you know, there are some parallels there with when you drive a car and you have to figure out, okay, how am I going to get where I'm going? Well, look at a map before you get in the car, like what we used to do. Yeah. You know, you don't have to just completely rely on your phone to do everything for you. And because it's there, we use it. I mean, I don't use it, but a lot of people use it. And it's just like, it's easier that way. We don't have to put any forethought into anything anymore. And a lot of times that's what gets us into trouble.
Indeed. Well, so what is the next thing that you're going to be taking on from the list?
The next thing I'm doing is riding a horse fast. So, you know, a lot of these things are a little subjective, so we'll see how fast I can get it to go. I've never been an equestrian, so, but I'm doing it in New Mexico. We're going back there for a one-year wedding anniversary, and that's what I'm trying to do with a lot of these things on the list. If it's not a place that he wanted to visit that's on the list, I try to at least do it in a different location so I can also sort of write about, you know, give it a sense of place. And he was just so, like, he was so interested in travel anyway that it totally goes along with what he would have wanted.
Excellent. Beautiful story. And everybody, go to myfatherslist.com to read about all the work that Laura Carney is doing right now. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Laura.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we've taken on one big topic, and we've been talking about it all evening, and that is this idea of big life goals and the bucket list and things like that. But we have, as we have been discussing throughout the program tonight, it is never really about doing that one activity. It is always about something much, much more, sometimes significantly more. We're here in studio with Dr. John Duffy, who's hanging out with us tonight because we bring him back onto the show anytime we say, what in the world makes us act that way or do that, or what compels us to do this big thing? So he is here with us tonight. We've been talking all about this very, very big topic. And I would love to welcome now our next guest, Robert Moore, who is the author of On Trails, An Exploration, the New York Times bestseller. It is now available in paperback, or it's about to be super soon, so you should get it. It is a really phenomenal book. I have just finished it myself, and it is lovely and beautifully, beautifully written. Robert, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
Thank you for taking part of your Saturday to be with us. Well, so although the book seems like it would be about your experience hiking the Appalachian Trail, it is indeed about so much more. So many topics dance through the pages of this book. But when you describe the book, how is it that you describe it to people who have not yet read it?
Yeah, it's a tough book to describe to people, I've noticed. And it's often a tough book for booksellers to know where to put, because it's a mixture of journalism and essay and memoir. But the way it begins is just with me hiking the Appalachian Trail and with the questions that I started to ask myself as I walked. That's really what this book is. It's an exploration of a series of questions that I mulled over for five months as I hiked, you know, from Georgia to Maine, and then continued to explore for the following 7 years it took me to ultimately write this book, exploring what a trail is and what a trail means, from insects to larger animals to ancient humans and modern humans and beyond.
Yeah, that's my really one of the things that I just loved so much about this book, of how every time you think you have covered all the ways a path can manifest, you're like, oh, nope, here's another way. And it's fascinating because suddenly you're looking at paths everywhere, all around us, even the way you touch on technology and interconnectedness. And I really loved about the thing about ants. I thought that was so interesting, and looking at them as this kind of, as the paths as civilization.
Yeah, that's right, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because that was the experience. That's what it felt like for me writing this, is that paths are something we don't often pay much attention to. You know, it's a very prevalent metaphor, and it's a very prevalent structure in our lives. We walk on paths all the time. You probably walk on one in the city, crossing a park, or taking a little shortcut somewhere every day, and yet we scarcely pay any attention to them. And so once I began paying attention to them, I saw them everywhere. And one of the first places I started to see them was little ant trails, because, of course, as kids, we've all paid attention to the amazing invisible ant trails we see ants following. And of course, as adults, we know they're formed by pheromones, but there's so much more to be learned about, and it's still being learned actually at this point by collective intelligence researchers about how ants manage to make trail networks that are so phenomenally efficient. They're so efficient that we actually use them to study how to route packages when shipping them across the country, or how to route information through the internet, how to sort tasks in a factory. All of these are things that ants do incredibly well because they're very selfish actors, and their intelligence is distributed. It's externalized because no individual ant is very smart, but the system is very intelligent, and the system is really their trails.
That is such an interesting way to put that. I'm really, really fascinated by that. How long into when you started hiking the Appalachian Trail? I know I do some hiking myself, and I know it takes a minute to kind of shake out the outside world and all of its distractions and all of that. How, at what point did you start seeing all these paths unfurling and start to see the world as a series of paths?
It was a slow realization. There was no one epiphany moment. I left to go hike the Appalachian Trail in 2009, and I was alone, and so there was a lot of time for me to hike and think and notice things. And one of the first things I started to notice is that a trail is not really a static thing. It's something that evolves continuously. And as a hiker, you notice this because if the trail doesn't go somewhere you want it to go, you create a shortcut. And if enough people follow that shortcut, that kind of becomes the de facto trail. And this is something that people who are historians of the Appalachian Trail will tell you right away, is that the length of the Appalachian Trail changes every year. The shape of it changes. It's quite a liquid thing. So that was very early on a realization that I had. And then later I started to notice the game trails through the woods. In the book, I describe an experience I had running into a black bear near a place called Nuclear Lake in New York. And I watched it as it trundled off into the woods, and I thought, all of these animals, I mean, because oftentimes those animals will follow the Appalachian Trail as well because it's been cleared. It's a kind of path of least resistance, although in other ways we can talk about it, it isn't. It's actually quite counterintuitive the way that it moves. But I started to notice that animals are following trails as well, and then you start to have that realization that this trail-following instinct and this trail-making instinct, you might say this trail-blazing instinct, is something that's quite universal to living things.
Well, and you talk about that a little bit later in the book. I believe it's in Chapter 3. You talk so much about animals beyond the ant. You talk about elephants and buffalo, and even you spent time with sheep and people around sheep to understand that connection there, which I really found fascinating, because it doesn't seem like a very obvious connection until you put them in the context of trails and paths.
Yeah, I did. I spent time out in the Navajo Reservation in Arizona herding sheep with one of the last groups of people who are still herding sheep on foot, I should say, in a traditional mode. And what I was interested in there, besides just the experience, and this is something that anyone can do, if you go online and you look for the Black Mesa Indigenous Network, you can find that you can volunteer to go help these aging Navajo families herd their sheep. So it's something that I was interested in doing just for the experience of it. But also I wanted to see how these sheep were moving collectively, how a flock of sheep, which are known as the biggest followers, the really the dumbest followers in the animal kingdom, right, how they were working together to not get lost. And you know, I thought as a shepherd, I would be walking through the hills and they would be trotting behind me. And of course, that was not the way it was at all. In fact, it was quite the opposite. I was chasing after them constantly, and they seemed to know where they were going most of the time. They were going to water. They were going to some different kind of forage. In fact, in the earliest days, they knew they could get to places where I wasn't supposed to let them. And they, in fact, on my very first day, pulled a clever little maneuver where they split up into two camps and moved away at a sort of equal pace, so I couldn't keep them together, and I ended up losing all of the sheep on my very first day of shepherding. But ultimately, I learned a lot about how animals collaborate and how we share information, and one of the ways that we do that is through trails.
It's so interesting. It's like when we have a substitute teacher when we're kids, we see what we can get away with. It seems like the sheep were doing that to you.
I was that substitute teacher,
Indeed.
Robert, this is John Duffy. I'm a clinical psychologist sitting in with Amy, and I'm fascinated with this idea of trails. And one thing I'm always drawn to is exceptions. So you describe a lot about the well-used trail, you know, and that there's a utility to that. And with humans, animals, any species, what do you make of, by and large, the trail less followed? You know what I mean? Like, what draws people or an animal to veer off the well-trodden trail and create something new?
Yeah, that's something I spent a lot of time thinking about. And I think as Americans, for some reason, we are particularly tuned to the romance of that, of the trailblazer or the person who goes off and strikes off on your own path. And that is something that I found physically. I mean, the if you go out and actually try to do that in real life, it's a perfect metaphor for what it is in your intellectual life or in any other realm. If you try and break new ground, as you say, these metaphors appear again and again for good reason, because it's really, really hard to not have a path. If you've ever gone off, it depends on where you are, of course. If you're out in the desert, it's a little bit easier. I've gone hiking in places with particularly dense brush, like in Maine or Newfoundland, which I describe in the book was the hardest, where you're walking cross-country without a trail. First of all, you're having to fight your way through the brush. And second of all, you have this constant nagging doubt and fear that you're off course because there's no reassurance. And that's what a trail is. It's someone having gone before you and having passed down that information to you. To say, if you stumble upon a trail in the woods, you don't know where it leads, but you know it leads somewhere because people aren't going to follow it if it doesn't lead somewhere. So in that way, it's a kind of wisdom that's passed down to us through the ages. The problem with that is when trails become too entrenched, they can lose their utility, right? And this is true both physically and metaphorically. If you're walking on a hiking trail that is too many people following it, it gets deeper, it gets muddier, it starts to erode. And also, it may become so entrenched that it no longer adjusts to changes in the environment. So if, for example, you're going to some beautiful outlook, some rocky outcropping, but that rocky outcropping collapses and the best view is actually, you know, 50 or 100 yards to the west, but the old trail still leads you to this place that's no longer of interest, that entrenched trail is become kind of a hindrance. And I think intellectually that's true as well. We need to always be wary of following trails that don't lead to places that are helpful anymore, that maybe had utility in the past, but don't today.
Which immediately, you know, having read this, my brain has been thinking in paths and trails lately. As you're saying that, I'm thinking even about the way we think about business innovation and tackling this idea of, well, we have to do it that way because that's the way it's always been done, versus someone who comes in who maybe doesn't know the legacy business and says, no, what if we did this? And suddenly they've changed the game. That's immediately what I think of when you say that.
Yeah, that's something that you know, I think that the tech industry has been particularly successful at doing is finding ways to continually break new ground, to push themselves, to shake up the paradigm. And I think it's why things keep advancing at such a fast pace, is that culture of throwing out the received wisdom or reexamining it, at least to find the things that work and question everything else and say, we don't need this anymore. This was built on an old system that no longer applies. That's something that any hiker, I think, any person who spent time in the woods knows on a very deep level, is that you have to continually adapt to the environment. And the people who go off and break new trail, we reward them as a culture because there's so much more investment there. There's so much more risk.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I another part of the book that I thought was so very interesting, kind of adjacent to this topic here, and that is about when you started looking at historical pieces and language and society and even like memories, I thought that part was very, very interesting too, that connection was made off of this concept of trails.
Yeah, the most interesting paradigm to look at in terms of that and the way that trails store information is with the Native Americans. In my experience, I was talking with a man who was mapping all the Cherokee trails in North Carolina, all of the Cherokee trails had existed before colonialism. And what he had found was that much of our road network is laid down directly on top of the Cherokee trails. And so a lot of it's literally entombed in concrete. We can no longer find it, but you can actually still find old remnants of it if you go out walking in the woods in North Carolina and elsewhere. You know, throughout Illinois, you can find it as well. You just have to know where to look. And when you start reading about the history and the culture of many Native American tribes who were moving primarily on foot, not moving primarily on canoe trails, which many tribes were, but many of these ambulatory-based cultures, the stories are woven into the trails. They're actually connected. And so if you read the old folklore, it's describing a journey across the landscape. And I've had people tell me, for example, that when the Cherokee were removed from North Carolina to Oklahoma, they took their stories with them. But they said the stories lost some of their power. There's a story about, you know, race between two turtles. And they said, you know, you can tell that story in Oklahoma, and that's a beautiful story. But when you tell it in North Carolina, on the very mountain where that story is taking place, you can actually look out and you can see the humps of the mountains, and they resemble turtle shells. And the story comes alive, and it has a very deep and rich resonance in a way that it no longer does in Oklahoma.
That is so interesting. Particularly, I mean, I had chills when you were describing the highways and these trails being entombed. That's so powerful to think about, you know, even as we're moving around our lives and going, you know, driving around doing things, to think about what is below, what is entombed below this path I'm on right now, which is so very interesting.
I grew up in Lake Forest, and there we have Deer Path Road, of course,
yeah.
Right? And you find old trail trees. I mean, these things are all around us. If you just begin doing a little bit of research, you can find them.
Yeah, very, very interesting, and lots of mind-expanding things throughout your book. I recommend it very, very highly to everyone who has not read it so far. But you mentioned the counterintuitiveness of trails, and I want to go back to that because I think that's a really interesting concept. We think of, of course, as you mentioned, the Appalachian Trail does move a little bit. Sometimes there's a mudslide or something, and so the parks will move it around and things like that. And so sometimes the mileage varies a little bit. I know this because I, too, am a little interested in perhaps tackling that trail in my lifetime. But the idea of it being counterintuitive is very interesting to me, because I think we so easily accept the conventional wisdom of, if that's where the path is, that's where I shall go. And so the idea of some of it being not just questionable, but important to question is very interesting to me.
Yeah, hiking trails are a very odd thing when you start looking into them, because it's really a basic animal instinct to follow the path of least resistance, right? To minimize your caloric expenditure. Almost all animals do that. You want to find the straightest, easiest path. But hiking trails are really often the opposite. They're following very screwy paths, because they're trying to do a lot of things besides just minimize your effort. They're trying to shed water efficiently, for example. That's one of the most important things that they do. They're also trying to avoid places that are sensitive. They have sensitive plant growth, things like that. So it really, the aim of a hiking trail is to be sustainable. It's to be sustainable over time, and to not befoul the surrounding environment. And that impetus, and also, so that's the one. The other is to find the most beautiful spots, right? To find the spots of maximum scenery, maximum enjoyment, maximum beauty. It's really an aesthetic experience. That's not something that most animals, as far as we know, think about at all or worry about. So humans, and really modern humans post the Romantic era, you know, in Europe and then in America, post Thoreau, that's when we start worrying about that stuff. It's and so our trails begin to evolve to echo and to capture those interests, and they take on a totally new form.
Indeed. The book is called On Trails and Exploration. I wish we had hours more to talk with you. This is such a fascinating book. I recommend everybody read it right away. It is there is so much there, and it is so fascinating, and it is definitely perspective shifting. Robert Moore, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
Thank you.